Wednesday, May 23rd is called order. Welcome everybody. It's good to see you all here. I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 108A. And Judith, do you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 108A creates a Class C traffic violation for operation without a forward cross-view mirror if it applies to a motor truck with a combined weight of 26,000 pounds or less that is used for the commercial delivery of packages. It does allow exception if the department, by rule, determines that a driver of a motor truck has a clear and unobstructed view that enables the driver to see persons or objects within 10 feet of the front of the motor truck. This offense would be have a fine of not to exceed $180. You do have before you the -A2 amendments. Those, that's my understanding, were brought to me by Senator Prozonsky. Those amendments create the offense of unsafe passing of a person operating a bicycle as a Class A traffic violation if the motor vehicle fails to leave a safe distance when passing a bicyclist on the left. It does define safe distance to mean a sufficient distance to prevent contact with the bicyclist if the person were to fall off the bicycle into the lane of traffic. This amendment does not apply if a motor vehicle driver is operating in a lane separate from and adjacent to a designated bicycle lane, is operating at a speed not greater than 30 miles per hour, or when the driver is passing a bicyclist on the right-hand side because the cyclist is turning left. It allows the driver of the motor vehicle to cross the center of the roadway to pass the bicycle if the oncoming lane is unobstructed and there's a safe distance to avoid oncoming traffic. It does require the driver to return to the authorized lane as soon as practicable, and it specifies that passing a bicycle in a no-passing zone constitutes a prima facie evidence of a violation if the passing results in injury or death of the person operating the bicycle. So we have that one amendment that I'm aware of that's before you at your seat at the dais. We have a no revenue and a minimal fiscal on the original engrossed version of this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Senator Walker, would you like to join us? Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. With me is Brandy Lyons and Richard Lane, and I'll have them speak in a moment. This bill comes to you. I'm pleased. I think Senator Prozonsky's hitching a ride, which is fine. I hitched a ride from the state police. They graciously allowed us to use this bill. This bill left the Senate last session and came to the House, and it didn't get a hearing. And I think there are people laying in the weeds in opposition to this bill. They've never shown themselves to me, either in person or in writing. So we're going to out them today, because I'm sure that now that this bill is getting a serious hearing, they might actually put themselves on the record and in public view. This bill came to me last session because Ms. Lyons and her husband lost their daughter. Their daughter was run over by a UPS truck, and the UPS truck was not equipped with forward cross-view mirrors, and Mr. Lane is going to illustrate what those are. It's a serious problem that can be fixed with a simple little mirror on the truck. And Mr. Lane will show you how those mirrors are already existing on school buses, because we've had children killed by school buses without them. They're on postal vehicles, and they can certainly be on delivery trucks. Last legislative session when I had this bill, it was Senate Bill 1027, I amended it pretty significantly to meet the concerns of some of the members who felt that it would put an impact, an adverse impact on small delivery vehicles that were in town, like little florist delivery vehicles, vans that go around town and give you flowers, like I got a bouquet of flowers delivered to me today, which is quite lovely. So we limited the weight to 26,000 pounds. I think That was our amendment. And we also said that the vehicle is used for commercial delivery of packages, and that if you can certify that your vehicle does not have a problem, that you can view out the front, then you don't need a mirror. We also exempted farm vehicles. So anybody here with the Farm Bureau or any of those sorts of folks can understand that this long ago exempted farm vehicles, and it never meant to cover farm vehicles. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Lyons so that she can speak about the tragedy that befell her and her family. And I know this is difficult for her to do, and I appreciate that she came up today. And I did not ask her to testify in the Senate because it is very hard to have her do that. So I have saved her testimony for you all, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess
before I know it's hard.
Oh yes, I'm sorry, I'm Brandy Lyons.
Thank you.
I guess the hardest thing going through all of this is how this could be prevented and needs to be prevented. Because as long as there are trucks who have blind spots, and most of the drivers have no idea that that there's even a problem with their trucks. But there is. They have got to have the safety equipment that they need to make sure that our children, our family is safe. Without these mirrors or any other safety device that would create an accident like this from happening, there's going to be millions of other children and families that are going to go through the same type of stuff that my husband and I went through, and it very well could be prevented, and it needs to be prevented, and I won't stop until it is. That's all I really have to say.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane, and I'm an attorney in Portland and represented Mrs. Lyons, Mr. Lyons, in connection with a wrongful death case involving Kennedy Lyons. And I provided the committee a short packet of materials here, and what I'd like to do is sort of walk through the materials because I think they illustrate both the problem and the solutions that are presently being employed by other vehicles and why 108 should be passed, and we fix this so that there's never a situation where Kennedy Lyons or another child is killed in one of the neighborhoods in Oregon. The UPS vehicle that we're discussing is illustrated on page 2 of the package materials. It's important that the committee understand that this vehicle was moving forward out of a common driveway inside of a condominium apartment type of structure in the Eugene Springfield area. The Kennedy Lyons was walking on the sidewalk with her bicycle. The package driver left the attempted delivery, jumped in the vehicle, and moved forward and over Kennedy Lyons while she was on the sidewalk. The driver was unaware that there was any blind spot on the vehicle. That came out slowly during the discovery process. On page 4 of the materials, I have included a letter from the City of Eugene police officers that investigated the accident. And the committee members, I'm not going to take your time to go through the whole thing, but in the third paragraph, the last line in that paragraph, the officers that did the investigation concluded, quote, "We discovered a driver could not see a child in front of the truck below 4'7.5" from the middle of the cab and below 4'11" from the driver's seat." So the investigators' officers concluded that there's a blind spot out there, the driver didn't know it, and that was the reason for the death. So the defect exists in the vehicle, and it really has little to do with the operator. The operator could be going slow, could be inattentive, could be doing everything within his power, and yet you would still have this defect in the vehicle. Page 5 represents a photograph of some demonstrative work that I put together representing the bike and Kennedy Lyons in front of the UPS vehicle. And you can see in the corner of the photograph, There's something called a busboy mirror. This is a busboy mirror. And if you look at page 6, this is a photograph of the busboy mirror being employed in that demonstrative that I used, and I took a photograph then from the driver's seat. The busboy is mounted, and I can walk up and show the committee members, but it basically shows the driver everything that's in front of them from the driver's seat. They don't have to get out. They don't have to do anything other than take a look like you would on any of your other mirrors on your vehicle. And it completely shows any of the blind spot in front of the vehicle. The busboy, I characterize as one of the Cadillacs out there in the industry. It's a pretty good mirror. There are other types. This is a convex mirror, and we're going to look at a photograph in a moment of where it's employed right now in Oregon communities. And it basically attaches to the vehicle in the same way, again, allowing the driver to sit in the driver's passenger seat and see anything that's obstructing out in front of them. And it's been suggested that, you know, perhaps if there was more vigilant training and more drivers taking a walk around, that would eliminate any type of a problem. Well, it doesn't, because we all have seen kids and grandkids, and they're kind of quick and they kind of move, and you may complete a circuit around, jump back in your vehicle, and during that period of time, a child may have gotten in front of the vehicle. Again, in the moment that you're moving forward, a busboy or a convict is going to give you that visibility straight down in front of the vehicle. If you look at page 7 of the materials, here's an example of the busboy being employed on Crystal Springs trucks that deliver water around the communities. Page 8 has the convex mirror mounted above the cab area on a waste management truck. If you're out in the airport, you take the long-term parking and you drive up to the terminal, you'll find the busboy is on all of the buses that they're using out at PDX. Obviously, we've all seen, page 10, school buses. School buses probably were the first ones to employ this type of device to eliminate the risk of a blind spot on a vehicle and a child being injured or killed. Photographs in 11 and 12 can be looked at together, but these are the U.S. mail trucks, and these are the most common ones. They're out in our neighborhoods day in and day out, and the United States government has shown fit to make sure that its entire fleet is outfitted with these forward enhancement visibility devices. These are larger trucks that have the convex mounted up on the top, and you can see how it's employed. If the driver let me jump in the cab then, I took a photograph of that. You can see the mirror up in the corner again, showing the visibility down below. The remainder of the materials are the accident investigation report, just for the committee's information. We believe that Senate Bill 108 solves a critical problem. It's going to prevent injuries. It's going to prevent deaths. It's an easy fix. It's an available fix. It doesn't impair the operation of the vehicle in any way. And it's going to prevent any type of another child being killed in communities where these trucks operate. So with that, I think all three of us would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Madam Chair, before we get to questions, I'd like Mr. Lane to explain how much those mirrors cost. I don't think I heard you say that. And I passed the mic with his lines while he was talking and asked her why UPS refused to install the mirrors. And I had remembered correctly, it was because they said it was too expensive. So it's okay to put children at risk because it was too expensive. And Mr. Lane will tell you these mirrors are very cheap.
Members of the committee, what I can tell the committee is what I can find out commercially. And these rates obviously change if a large company tries to negotiate with any of these companies that manufacture these for a large order number. Obviously, the greater number of materials purchases are going to affect the actual cost per item. But if you just go on a website and you try to look for a busboy or whatnot, they start at approximately $60 and go down to about $8.36. The various types of mirrors that might be available there. As I said, the busboy is a Cadillac. I'm sold on it. Got no interest in the busboy company, but there are a number of products that are available across a mean of, you know, $60 or less.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I note in the bill there is no requirement for any particular brand of a forward crossview mirror. Simply a forward crossview mirror is required. So from what you've just said, then a possibly $8 to $9 mirror would fit the need. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that is correct. And there's also the out inside the bill of certifying that you don't have a blind spot, which would eliminate that as well, any need for anything.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I would also say that when I was speaking with my staff today, Sophia Hitty, she said when she took her driver's test, there was a question on the driver's test for just her Oregon driver's license, and asked her what she should do before she backed up. And she remembered her mother's coaching, and her mother said, answer the most conservative answer on your driver's test. So she answered the most conservative answer was get out, take a look around your vehicle before you get in and back it up. And she was correct. And it is listed in the driver's manual that before you back up, you must be sure it is safe to do so and that you will not interfere with other traffic. It is a good idea to go behind the vehicle to make sure a child, pet, or toy is not in the way. Back slowly from a driveway into a street. Well, you could say that these drivers could all be trained to look around their vehicle to make sure there's no child or toy or pet. But as Mr. Lane explained, children move rather quickly. These drivers also move rather quickly. They're on a clock. And whether this driver moved quickly or not, he could not see this young child in front of his truck. He simply could not do it because of the height of the child and the height of his seat. So that argument, I don't think, works very well. And, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't know I was supposed to get out and look around my vehicle when I get in it every day. I just get in it, I hit the garage door, and the garage door goes up, and I start backing up. So, what if there's something behind my vehicle? So we all should really actually think about that after today.
Senator Walker, in your research, have you checked to see what other states do on this, whether there are requirements?
Madam Chair, I know that New York inquired last year after the bill fell. New York was moving forward. I have not checked to see if they did that or not. I don't know if any other states have required it. I know other states have required the mirrors on the back. But beyond that, I haven't looked any further, and I really didn't think that it was all that important because I think this is an important bill, whether other states do it or not. And as I said, the bill says that there are trucks that are driven or moved on any highway, if they're expected to be driven or moved on a highway, and the motor truck has a combined weight of 26,000 pounds or less that is used for commercial delivery of packages or other property, then it must be equipped with a crossview mirror. So we're not talking about the farm vehicles. We're not talking about the flower vans. We're talking about these commercial vehicles that are out in the neighborhoods all the time, every day. You see them every single day.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Walker, I want to follow up on that statement. What do you envision in terms of a plumber or an electrician who shows up with a truck? Would this apply to them?
If the truck is 26,000 pounds, but they are not in use, they're not in the commercial delivery of packages. They're there, as Mr. Madam Chair and Representative Smith, they're not there to deliver packages. They're there to fix your sink or your toilet or whatever.
So follow
so
up.
So it wouldn't apply.
So I do want to make sure I'm really clear on this. Your true intent is those folks who are delivering packages start and stopping throughout communities.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. As I said, they're in your neighborhood every day. At least they are in mine. There's a neighbor of mine that orders a lot of stuff. I order a lot of stuff, so they're in your neighborhood, and the postal vehicle's there every day, and they've got their cross-view mirror, and there's children and pets in our neighborhood, and they can see them.
Thank you.
You're
Representative
welcome.
Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Walker, for bringing this bill to us, and thank you for you folks, and I'm so sorry about your daughter's death. Thank you for coming today. There was some question. It's clear to me, I just want to state it on the record. This was not meant at all to cover rentals, car rentals. Absolutely not, correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, No, the bill's not written to cover car rentals. It's only commercial trucks.
Just delivery trucks.
Yeah, that weigh at least 26,000 pounds.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Butler,
thank
welcome
you, Madam
back.
Chair. For those of us who may live on border communities, Senator Walker, what of the delivery trucks that come into Oregon to make one delivery from Pasco, Washington, to deliver into Representative Smith's district or that cross over the river to drop off something here from Washington or Idaho or California? Would they be then required, licensed in another state, to get these attached at the border or what?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, I believe they would. There's nothing that says that your vehicle has to be licensed in Oregon. It's part of the Oregon Vehicle Code. But, Mr. Lane, do you have anything to say differently?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, no, I think it would be. And in my experience, you don't have a lot of that interstate commerce on these types of vehicles. The schemes have them registered inside of the state, delivering out of regions and districts that are designed inside of Oregon. So maybe there is a situation that you're referring to, but it's not a significant one in my mind.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up, it is significant from Boise to Ontario. It is significant from Boise to Baker City. It is significant to Boise to Harney County. Those vehicles are licensed in Idaho. They come out of Idaho. They do service Idaho and then drop over into Oregon to take care of some of those things. But as long as they're operating in Oregon, then they would be required to have the mirrors installed. Is that correct then?
Madam Chairman, Representative Butler, there's no exception, as the bill is drafted right now, for a vehicle that comes into the state. If it's delivering a product in the neighborhood in an Oregon community, then the bill as drafted would apply.
Follow up, if I may. Would packages include then my rental U-Haul then at that particular point?
Madam Chairman, Representative Butler, as Senator Walker indicated, there's no application of the rental vehicle at all to the bill. I think it was a follow-up to Representative Tomei's question. So, no, I don't think it applies in that situation.
Okay. A question regarding the mirrors themselves, if I may.
Yes.
I take it, Mr. Lane, where you're an attorney, that you've had some experience with regard to these kinds of accidents, both cross-view mirror in front and rear cross-view. By preponderance, are there more backup accidents from without clearance in the rear, as Senator Walker was talking about, or are there more cross-view in the front accidents?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I'll answer it in two parts. Are we talking today, or are we talking 5 years ago? And the reason why I say that is a number of years ago, states recognized that the backing visibility was a problem. And starting in Washington and New York and other states, excuse me, legislatures moved to require rear visibility devices. So for UPS, for example, it has a camera mounted in the back that displays in the cab everything that the driver would see if he was out there in the back. It has a picture tube that he can just look at, she can look at, and see everything back there. Most of the package delivery trucks, if you're in the Portland area, see them on the streets, all have the rear concave mirrors showing the driver what's in back. So we focused on the problem, we came up with the solution, and eliminated those injuries and deaths arising from the rear situations. So I don't have a number for you, but I think they were far greater a number of years ago, rear to front. I think the rear problem has been significantly reduced due to the rear visibility devices, and I don't have a recent number then with the fixed rear problem versus the front.
Follow up on that question, if I may. So the rear cross-view devices of one kind or another are required under state law?
Representative Butler, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, that's what I believe for certain types of vehicles.
Clarification, for certain types of vehicles, the vehicles that we're talking about here and more or less than the vehicles that we're talking about here?
Madam Chairman, Representative Butler, I think it's greater than the ones that we're talking here, but I would appreciate the opportunity maybe to give you some specifics on that and on that question, and I get to my research and try to find exactly what they cover as far as the rear visibility devices.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mrs. Lyons, it's good having you here, and my sympathy goes out to you. What a beautiful young lady you had here. So she's a beautiful girl. Senator Walker, I want to make sure I get my arms around this so I understand the full implications. And so I want to add one more scenario, if I may. What about newspaper deliverers? In my community, I deliver newspapers. Well, what if I chose to deliver newspapers in my community? Would I be obligated to put these on my car?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, does your car would have to weigh 26,000 pounds and be used for commercial delivery of packages. I know that most
or less. So would I
don't know how much a car weighs. I'm not very good at that. Mr. Lane, do you know?
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, I don't know the approximate weight of, but from my...
Oh, I know my Suburban 6,000 pounds.
I think as you get smaller in size of the vehicle, closer to what we're used to seeing, a common van, you eliminate the visibility problem. The glass typically tends to go down further. You don't have a visibility problem. So as I sit here right now, I don't think that the bill would impact those particular mom-and-pop newspaper delivery type services.
And Madam Chair, Representative Smith, excuse me, it would have to be a motor truck, not a car. And you can, in subsection 3 of section 2 on lines 14 through 17, you can certify by rule with the department. The department will develop rules, and you certify that your vehicle you can see. So that would most likely exempt your vehicle if you have an SUV or something like that.
Just to follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Okay, and again, this is the first time I've read this. I apologize. I should have come more prepared to committee. And again, so I just want to understand the intent. So if I have a pickup and I can see to the front of it, then your intent is that I would be able to be exempt from this.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that would be correct. You would get a certification that you can see and you don't need a cross-view mirror. And that's only if you're in the business of commercial delivery.
Right.
If you're a newspaper carrier, right. We don't have very many on-foot carriers anymore. Most of them are car routes. That would be true. And, Madam Chair, I do need to correct something because I was asked about rental vehicles. Rental vehicles, no. But then there was a discussion about U-Haul vehicles. The bill doesn't specifically exempt rental vehicles. It only applies to motor trucks that are in the business of commercial delivery of packages or other property. So I would suspect that I didn't think about the U-Haul vehicles unless it specifically exempts rental vehicles like U-Hauls. It likely would apply because they're in the business of commercial delivery of goods or property. So I do have to correct myself.
Thank you.
And as you know, U-Haul vehicles move frequently from state to state. People drive them to move. Actually, I think I've seen these mirrors on these types of vehicles, but maybe not. Representative Butler shaking his head.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and our sympathies. And
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Pazansky.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives, committee members. I just want to make sure the A2s have been delivered to everyone, make sure everyone has had an opportunity. I tried to hand out some earlier. Senate Bill 108, A2s is an option for you to consider incorporating into the current SB 108. What we're asking to do at this point, as it's written out, is to add in a safety measure that would protect cyclists, bicyclists, as they're operating on the roadways, and an individual who is driving a motor vehicle who would want to pass that vehicle, making certain that they took in consideration the distance that is necessary to pass that cyclist without endangering that individual. Specifically, when you look on page 1 of the amendment, starting on line 6, it has section 3, and it sets forth what the requirements would be for passing a cyclist on the roadway. What we're trying to do is make certain that the roadways are safe. Many of you know that one of my riding partners was killed last year in May while she was on a training ride. And that situation occurred when a truck that was in an area of on a county road was attempting, or actually a state road, was attempting to make a pass where the road was less than 20 feet wide. The truck was an 18-wheeler, and the distance that it takes up in the lane was one that basically would accommodate within the lane, but could not really accommodate a bicycle and the truck in the same lane. The driver of that vehicle made a decision to try to pass in an area that at the point of where the passage took place was in a no-passing zone. There was a situation, and Jane Higdon is the individual. She's an experienced rider. You'll hear a little bit more about her on the next bill that you're going to be considering, Senate Bill 789. And I will save that description for then. But I can tell you that the individual she was riding with had many years of experience riding together, as well as just the number of miles that they log on an annual basis. What happened to Jane is that she fell onto the roadway, and when she fell on the roadway, as you can kind of imagine, if you just had a bicycle and you just fell over like the Artie Johnson style on the Laughing on the tricycle, how far the body of the individual falls into the lane. And in this particular case, the truck misjudged, in my opinion, as to the ability to get around the vehicle, cyclist in a safe manner. And when Jane did fall, she was caught up underneath the back end of the rig and was killed instantly. So what we're attempting to do is really put into statute a measure for individuals who are operating motor vehicles to be able to understand the need to make certain there's a safe distance when they're passing. And it goes through the criteria as to exactly what would be required. It also gives some exemptions as to where it would not apply, specifically where you have a separate bike lane that has been marked and adjacent to the travel lane for the cars that is a can be marked by a single stripe. Currently, the bill is written for, or they're driving at speeds not greater than 30 miles an hour, or when the individual is attempting to pass the bicyclist on the right side, because the cyclist has moved over to the left-hand area to make a left-hand turn. That is the crux of the bill. There are some other points on the backside as to setting up what I would call a presumption that the person was, in fact, passing in an unsafe manner when they try to pass in an area that has been marked as a no-passing zone. Now, there are statutes already on the books that do allow drivers to move over the double line, dividing the two lanes going in each direction, and that is taken into consideration, and that is found on page 2, where someone could be passing in a no-passing zone in violation of that statute would be that prima facie case. The last is basically applying that following too close to a vehicle would apply to motor vehicles at this time. That is the amendment that I bring before you. I have just been contacted outside prior to this hearing to one of the interests that they had some request for maybe some additional language to be, or substitution language. We have not had an opportunity to go through that. I believe in speaking to the chair was not planning on moving the bill today, and what I would like to do is have an opportunity to meet with them and see if we can have a meeting of the minds as to that part. If you have any questions regarding this dash A2, I'll be glad to try to answer those questions at this time.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Representative Butler?
Oh, thank you, Chair. Senator Brzezinski, thank you very much for the A2 amendment. My concern is relative to page 2 under section 3 and number 2 there, passing a person operating a vehicle and no passing zones violation and constitutes prima facie evidence of commission of an offense in this section, unsafe passing of a person operating a bicycle. Doesn't that make a presumption then? Doesn't that give a bicycle a superior right over a motorist where there isn't a bicycle lane?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I do not believe that's the case. When you look at the statute, and I don't have it in front of me, but when you look at the statute 811.420, there are two components to it. The first part is basically says that it is in violation when you cross over the double yellow line to pass. But then there's an exception that's built into that statute. Thank you, Representative. Then there's an exception into that statute when you look under what would be 3B. It says when an obstruction or condition exists making it necessary for the driver to go to the left of the center of the roadway, and doing so shall yield the right-of-way for any oncoming vehicles. So I think the question here and the part that needs to be addressed is that basically an individual who is going to try to do a passing of an individual who's on a bicycle where there's a double yellow line for no passing needs to be more cautious in doing so, because there's a reason for that line to already be there. The rule of the road for a cyclist is to ride as closest, nearest to the right as possible. That's reasonably safe. And the issue in this particular case regarding Jane Higdon, the testimony, the evidence is somewhat contradictory, but what we know for a fact is that the fog line actually leaves the pavement and actually goes on to gravel. And there could have been, we know one of the cyclists in front actually went down based on their perception as to how close they believed the truck was. And what we believe was not taken into consideration by that driver at that moment was the reaction that the cyclist would have in trying to move over to the right and what hazard that might put to them. And in this particular case, there's been no demonstration as to whether or not Jane's front wheel touched any bike in front of her, but we know that she went down for whatever reason. It had rained earlier in the day, and then it was in that position. I would say under that statute that a person who's operating within the framework of the existing statute would be protected. But also, we also believe that an individual, before they make that change to move and pass a cyclist, just like they would do a small or slow-moving farm vehicle, such as a tractor, that they are going to make certain that they have safe distance to pass and have reasonable distance to make the pass and get back into the lane before they have any let's say, hit incident with a vehicle coming in the other direction. So I think the way that this is written in the sense of the amendment and working with what the existing statute, it does not give a superior right for the cyclist. It's basically the driver is going to be held to the same standard, but if there is an accident that occurs, then there's going to be a prima facie case or a rebuttable presumption that that individual that was operating the vehicle did unsafe pass that cyclist. Now, they could overcome that by demonstrating as to why they did what they did and what they had going on in the sense of the scenario of no traffic coming in the opposite direction. They could actually see down the road or such, you know, those type of situations to actually get around that. But what we're attempting to do is make certain that where you already have the state or a governmental entity saying that these areas of the road are less safe than others, that people, instead of maybe trying to squeeze in and get around, that maybe they just need to wait a few moments and then make their pass in an area on the road where there is not a no-passing zone.
Follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up, please.
I guess my concern is that I don't care whether you're in Eastern Oregon or whether you're in Western Oregon. I can pick out some spots this weekend on the Oregon coast where bicyclers, lane after lane after lane of them, were along the side of the road, and for many, many, many miles, dual lines, no passing lanes. Now I may be able to see around them in a car that I can clearly pass 5 or 10 of them, but I may not be able to pass a line that's 50 or 60 of them without basically stopping behind the bicycles. They're going uphill. I'm going uphill. They're going uphill much slower. That hill could last for around curves and so forth for as much as a half hour. Would I be then required to basically park my car and wait for these bicyclists?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, I guess it was going to be on a case-by-case basis. The issue or the example you give today was probably to reach the beach ride, which started in three different locations in this state and ended up in Pacific City. At least that's the one that I know that occurred this last weekend. One of those type of rides, yes, there were, my understanding, 2,000, maybe 3,000 riders that converged on Pacific City, and at that point they would have all been in the same area. I would say that depending on that particular area, I've ridden that route, did not do it that ride this last weekend, but I've actually participated in that ride twice before, and I've ridden that area before. I would say that as a motorist, you would have the right to pass them and you go into across the double yellow line so long as it's safe. There would be in some cases where, and especially in some of the areas of eastern Oregon where you do have some of the hill climbs that are on curves, and in those areas I would think that it would be the driver would be more at risk as to, let's say, rushing to get around them. But clearly, no, they would not have to wait and park their car. They would just need to make certain that if they were going to do the passing, that they left reasonable distance between them and the cyclist, and that they are not going to obstruct any oncoming traffic.
Just one more follow-up, Madam Chair. In eastern Oregon, we have something that's indigenous to eastern Oregon, unfortunately, and it's called puncture vine. And the cyclists do not respect the fog line because they don't want their tires flat. And the concern that I've got is that these folks basically are using up a lane of traffic. And I know that you're a cyclist aficionado, but my concern is that those folks don't want their tires flat and will use up a lane of traffic. And in that process, then what happens is, and I know that the rule is that they ought to be over to as far as they possibly can to the right-hand side, but that's where the puncture vines actually will grow out to and beyond the fog line, so that the folks are just saying, you know, I don't want to put myself through that kind of a situation. And we're not talking about the size of a tractor. Typically, the farm tractors that we're talking about are bigger and wider than cars and other vehicles. So I guess I'm still concerned that what we're doing is we are conferring a greater right on cyclists. And particularly, not all cyclists are as kind and generous and perhaps as open as you and other cyclists may be that have do this professionally on a regular basis. My concern is that there are a lot of places where these folks do not respect that far right-hand corner, the right-hand side of the road, because they don't want the flat tires because of the puncture vines, and they are taking up the better portion of a lane of traffic, which then leaves my people that are using the roads with a cyclist. My motorists are then left in a situation where they're basically coming down to as low as 3 or 4 miles an hour, waiting for a cyclist or a group of cyclists to get around those areas, and could be literally could be as much as 15 minutes in lanes of traffic waiting for the cyclist, and that creates a much more unsafe situation than we started off with.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. and Representative Butler. Current law does allow for a cyclist, and under our law, a cyclist has the right to the roadway just as much as a motor vehicle. In fact, that vehicle is a vehicle under the code. Based on the example you've given, that cyclist has actually the right to be in that lane of traffic, not on the outside of the fog line. Most cyclists are pretty smart and realize that if there's a paved fog line shoulder, that it is safer for them and more courteous for those around them to ride there. But we actually passed legislation last session that actually allows an individual that's in a designated bike lane to leave the bike lane when there's an obstruction or some type of a road hazard to keep them from actually having an accident injury or damage to their vehicle. So under those scenarios that you've given, under current Oregon law, the cyclist has the right to ride to the furthest edge of the right side of that travel lane, and that fog line is not, and it's not been incorporated to represent a bike lane, even though most of us who are riding realize that it's much safer to do that. Now I agree, in eastern Oregon you do in fact have the issues of the puncture grass, as I can attest to personally and with friends who have ridden in eastern Oregon. But I would tell you that we also realize that under our current motor vehicle, or not motor, but our current vehicle code, we have recognized and acknowledged that a bicycle, even though it's not motorized, has every right to be on that road, just as a vehicle that is motorized. But at the same time, we also expect that they will ride as far nearest to the right as they can.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for clarifying. Back when I remember taking a bicycle safety course, that's what I was told. If the road is narrow, and maybe you can help me clarify this, if the road is narrow, that you're better off riding in the middle of the road if a car would not have enough room to go around you if there are two double lines and they can't safely go into an outline if we're talking about a two-lane road. Am I correct in remembering that?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm not sure of that teaching as to the course. I would tell you I personally do not do that. What we, the individuals I ride with, we always try to ride as furthest to the right as possible and not try to take up a lane. Now, there are times where if you're going into what I call high-speed turns downhill, where we will actually move more into the center of the lane, because at that point in time you're now doing anywhere from 30 to 50 miles an hour on a downhill, and it is not safe to get a vehicle around you even if they can safely get into the left lane, because neither you or the car that's trying to pass you realize what's coming around that next curve. And those areas, I can tell you that it is pretty common practice to, let's say, move from the right side. And I would say that the law would allow us to do that because safety would say that that is the best course. But on a standard flat road, I would say that that training is not what is being taught today. Now, another person that's here to testify on the next bill, Scott Ricker, could probably give you a little bit more information as to how they train young people as to riding, but I've not heard that. And at least the people I ride with do not practice riding in the middle of the road when it's just narrow and it's a double lane. We realize that the statute, actually, again, when you go back to that statute that Representative Butler and I just spoke about, 811.420 contemplates that a vehicle will, in fact, be able to go around the slower moving vehicle, in this case, or an obstacle, and actually cross over the double yellow line. That is legally proper.
Follow-up. So if one were behind a farm implement, a tractor, something that is going very slowly in these areas, do you think it's appropriate then for people to cross over that double line if in a faster vehicle?
Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, yes, if the circumstances present themselves that when they cross that double yellow line, they are not going to be a hindrance to the traffic that's coming toward them. Again, if you had a straightaway where you can see pretty much what is coming at you and there's no cars or trucks coming at you, yes, that would be appropriate. If this was on a 90-degree hairpin type turn or whatever degree it is that you can't actually see beyond that curve, I would say no, and they should wait until they can actually have a better view to be able to perform the execution of going around them.
Follow-up. So I'm hearing from you that a bicycle has as much right to be on that road as a farm tractor does, right, even though it may be slower than an automobile.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, that's exactly what the law is. A bicycle is identified as a vehicle. Believe it or not, a skateboard in some courts have been determined to be a vehicle. And so you do, in fact, have provisions that basically the next bill you hear is going to be share the roads, and you'll understand why we're bringing that forward as to trying to educate and get more information out to the general public through a means of displaying on license plates. Because the law as it is, even though some people may not be familiar with it, all vehicles have the right to the road. None of them, and this goes to Representative Butler, has a superior right. They all have to coexist and have to stay within the bounds of what the laws are for each of the vehicles. And in this case, bicycles have a duty to ride as furthest to the right as possible. And at the same time, we hope that anyone that is trying to pass that type of vehicle or any other sole moving vehicle will use the caution that's necessary before executing a passing in an area where it's not safe to pass without going into the other lanes.
And I'm going to go in a different vein, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I'm concerned in especially downtown Portland streets that are pretty narrow, and members of my family, that's their main way of commuting is by bicycle. But I see how wide the buses are and how narrow the lanes are. It is very frightening to me that if a bicycle is pulling over as far to the right as they can, if they were to fall in front of a bus, I mean, there was no room. So in those circumstances, I mean, I want to know what you suggest. And one of the things I wonder if, in that case, if it wouldn't be better for a bicyclist to get in the middle of the road rather than, because if they were to fall in front of the bus, there isn't enough room on the right for them to pull off. That would leave room for them if they did fall off their bicycle, as your friend did. They would be hit by the bus.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Tomei, I mean, again, I think this has to actually be looked on a case-by-case basis, and I am in discussions with TriMet as to some of the concerns about the transit. I mean, we have to coexist, and when you look at Portland has been designated as one of the heaviest populated areas for bicycle use for commuting, and it is a means for individuals to be able to go from location to location. Again, these are the type of situations I think that as a cyclist, I know that I will, especially in an area that I'm going to be commuting, I'm going to know what are my alternative routes to use wherever possible. In some cases, as you get closer to the river, you're limited as to what you can do to get across the river and actually access those access points. And then depending on what type of street it is, if they allow on-street parking, there's many other things that can be hazards for someone that's riding as close to the right, because you could actually be riding into a door that's open in front of you. So there's a lot of those other things, and so it's hard for me to say what they should do under any particular situation. But the law, and I believe the common practice, is that you should ride as far over to the right as reasonably possible, and that is safe.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Representative
Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good seeing you, Senator. A couple quick questions, and the first one is more of a housekeeping question. Have you had an opportunity to speak with the Lions about amending Senate Bill 108? The family that Senator Walker that introduced Senate Bill 108?
Madam Chair, Senator, or Representative Smith, I spoke with Senator Walker prior to this coming forward, and she agreed that she thought that this was also an issue of safety and would fit fine in the bill, and she had no objection to it being offered as an amendment.
Okay. I just want to make sure that the family is okay with that.
Yeah.
Follow-up question, if I may. On page 2 on section 4, we add the word motor to drives a motor vehicle so as to allow another vehicle more closely than is reasonable and prudent. How come that only applies to motor vehicles? How come that doesn't apply to bicycles?
Well, current law does as a vehicle. And motor, what we looked at was the risk and danger that what we've had in this particular case of where you actually have a motorist who will actually get right on the backside of the cycle.
and the risk is much greater when you have a motor vehicle doing that as compared to having a bicycle that may be in close proximity to the other cyclist. So we are trying to distinguish between the two as to where the risk is much greater by having someone that's on a motor vehicle that's following as close, because of the risk is so much greater to the in this case the vehicle in front of the cyclist.
Follow up. Before I ask my next question, I just want to point out, if there is just a little more kindness in the world, this bill wouldn't be necessary. And then more of an observation, I have had bicyclists who do get right on your tail and do create a little bit of a distraction for a driver, but that's an observation. Last question, and I am sympathetic to the issue that you're bringing forward. I guess I need a little 101 here, and maybe, Judith, you can help us. What's a Class A traffic violation?
Class A.
What's the consequence of a Class A traffic violation?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, a Class A traffic violation carries a fine of up to $720.
Yeah. There are four classifications, A, B, C, and D. The next one, which was a B, is up to 360, I believe, and then a C is, I think, half of that or close to that. I forget exactly what, but they're just different levels and what the maximum fine could be.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
See any other questions? So thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I have a number of other people signed up on this bill. Do you want me to let you testify on the other bill, or do you want to?
Madam Chair, I actually have my Commerce Committee going on right now. What I'd like to do is maybe return to it and make sure everything's going okay down there, since I'm chairing that committee, and just see where they're at. And then when you're ready, I will ask my staff to come and get me, and maybe council will be able to just let them know about when you want me to break from there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I have Bob Russell and Al Elkins and Mike Wagner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. And first I'd like to say that as a parent, my greatest nightmare, as I'm sure with most of you, has been the loss of a child. And I was very fortunate that tragedy was not visited upon my family. And I am truly sorry for your loss. Having said that, the Oregon Trucking Associations, our number one priority is highway safety. And everything that I do here or anyplace else is viewed through that lens. So what I'd like to do is sort of walk you through Senate Bill 108, look at its impacts, and see if we can't figure out if this is the right way to deal with the situation. As Senator Walker said, this requires forward cross-view mirrors on motor trucks with a loaded weight of 26,000 pounds or less. So it's not 26, it goes all the way down basically to zero. So it's 26,000 down to zero, but it is a motor truck. That is used for the commercial, so it's for hire, delivery of packages or other property. And that other property is a real key phrase in the bill. When you look at the term motor truck, it's defined at ORS 801.355. And what it means is a motor vehicle that is primarily designed or used for carrying loads other than passengers. The term property is not specifically defined in statute, although it's in a number of statutes. And the term is generally accepted to mean everything other than passengers. So any inanimate object, not inanimate, because livestock would be included in the term property, but people are not. So when we look at those terms, it's pretty broad. There is a provision in the bill that would allow owners of these vehicles to certify that they have a clear and unobstructed view within 10 feet of the front of the vehicle. Now, when I start thinking about that, and it says so that you can see a person or object, and object is not defined, but I know in the situation that Ms. Lyons was talking about, the child was very, very close to the front of the vehicle. So I'm assuming that what that means is that you have to be able to see right up and close to the vehicle. I believe that that's what that means. When you're talking about trucks, virtually no one is going to be able to certify that they can see that way. If you think of a UPS vehicle, for example, they do not have a nose on them or a hood, or the engine is inside the cab, and there isn't much of an extension beyond the windshield. They're pretty flat up and down like a cargo van. And the driver sits up pretty high, and you know, clearly they can't see with real close to that vehicle. And sort of, I mean, when you think about a four-wheel drive pickup truck that's got that long nose on it and sits up high, a child could very well be hidden from view if it were close to the vehicle. So I don't believe that the certification provision will have much, if any, application. So I don't think that is viable. When I checked with ODOT to see sort of what we were talking about in terms of the population of vehicles, there's 29,583 motor trucks with a combined weight between 26 and 10,000. They can identify those because they have T plates or truck plates. There's 7,102 farm trucks, which I do believe would be covered under this bill. There are also thousands of pickup trucks and cargo vans that are involved in this type of activity. And it's impossible to tell how many there are that would fall under the definition of this bill. But when you start thinking about the different applications, clearly there are a large, large number. You're talking commercial delivery folks, household goods movers, armored cars, beer and wine distributors, bakery trucks, tow trucks, rental trucks, and retail delivery trucks from the furniture store, the office supply. I mean, it's just there's a significant number, without question. Now, there's another sort of group here, and that you've asked some questions about. What about contractors? What about utility companies? When you look at the statutory construction and the sort of the chapter that deals with these distinctions is chapter 825, and 825.010 has the definitions in it, and there are three definitions that would be relevant here. One of them is the definition of a motor carrier. And basically what it says, a motor carrier means a for-hire or private carrier. A for-hire carrier is either a for-hire carrier of property or passengers. And the same is true with a private carrier. A private carrier is not hauling for hire. It's hauling its own goods, but it's either a property carrier or a passenger carrier. And then there is a partial definition of the term property. And it includes things like equipment, ballast, all of that kind of stuff that's either affixed to or carried on or part of the vehicle. So the definition is really broad. So when you think about, for example, the plumber, and he goes out to your residence and he brings some pipes and some faucets and some stuff, that's clearly property. He's commercial and he's delivering that property. So I think, in my opinion, that would be included. I'm not a lawyer. And the question becomes, which I have not had the opportunity to ask, is how would a policeman or how would a judge view that situation? In my opinion, from a transportation point of view, all of those folks would be subject to this, the provisions of this. To my knowledge today, school buses are the only vehicles that are required to have front cross-view mirrors. And that's under federal regulations. To us, it makes some sense. Because a school bus driver does not get out of the vehicle. And so they do not have the opportunity to check and make sure the path is clear. So putting cross-view mirrors on a bus where the driver doesn't get out of the vehicle makes sense. Conversely, when you're delivering property, the driver gets out and unloads the property, and they have the opportunity to check to make sure the path is clear, as Senator Walker was talking about the appropriate way to check before you back up. There have been tragic accidents with vehicles equipped with cross-view mirrors, and there have been accidents with those that aren't. You know, sort of the one thing that we have a difficult time in this building dealing with is human error. You just cannot eliminate that entirely. However, people do have recourse to the judicial system in those cases. Let me just briefly talk about the specific situation that brought us here. There was a lawsuit following the tragedy, and it was settled, and as part of the settlement, there's an agreement not to discuss the case. So I was not able to discuss any of the specifics of that case with UPS. We did talk about how they train their drivers. They are the largest trucking company in the world. And one of the most dedicated to safety in the world. But what they train their drivers to do is, particularly when we're talking residential areas, is they're coming down the street and they can see the driveway, for example, very clearly out the side window. They have to check and make sure that area is clear, and then they pull forward and back in. And they are equipped with rear view cameras so that they can clearly see out of the back. The driver then gets out of the vehicle, delivers the package. And the driver returning to the vehicle is instructed to walk down the passenger side and then across the front of the vehicle to make sure it's clear before he or she gets back in the driver's seat and pulls forward. That is the normal practice. That is what they have trained their folks to do and what they believe to be most safe. In my mind, cross-view mirrors make a lot of sense when the driver stays inside of the vehicle because it does increase their field of vision. Although, when I was first learning to drive, I remember my father telling me, do not trust your mirrors. Always look to the side to make sure that you are clear before you pull into the next lane or whatever you're doing. Because the mirrors can be out of adjustment, there are blind spots, there are all those kinds of things. And a lot of my companies believe that to be true, and they train their drivers, as does UPS, to make sure that the front of the vehicle is clear before they pull out. And they believe that that is the safest practice. Now, just before I got to the hearing this afternoon, I had asked ODOT for some statistics about incidents between school buses, which are required to have the cross-view mirrors, and pedestrians. And since 97, there have been 14 instances where school buses have hit pedestrians. One was a fatal. There were also, which I don't quite understand, there were 4 instances where pedestrians hit school buses. And there was one instance where there were 2 vehicles involved, including a school bus and a pedestrian. So I think that in the interest of safety, that we clearly need the option of being able to physically check the front of the vehicle and make sure that it's clear, and not be totally reliant on cross-view mirrors, particularly with the mirrored vehicles that we're talking about of all kinds of design. That concludes my testimony on 108, and if you'd like, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to address Senator Posansky's amendment.
Certainly. Go ahead.
Reviewed Senator Posansky's amendment and had a discussion with him earlier today about his amendment. And I do believe that his amendment will improve highway safety, and we are supportive of his amendment.
Okay. Representative Smith, Representative Tomei after him.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was a flaky college student, I worked for a major, don't say it, I worked for a major, utility in Portland, and one of the things that we were trained to do in our training was, before you got in your vehicle, you got out and you walked around your vehicle. The question I have for you is, you talked about that the UPS vehicles have cameras that look into the back.
Correct.
Do we statutorily require those?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we do not require the cameras, and I did not anticipate that we were going to ask about the mirrors in the back, so I didn't investigate that. I'm not aware that they are required.
Okay, just to follow up. So it's safe to assume that UPS thought it was just a good business practice, and as a result, they just chose to install them.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, as I said, UPS is very concerned about safety, and they will go to the expense and do what they believe is necessary to conduct their operations as safely as possible. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Russell. Mr. Russell, Senator Walker seemed to indicate that you did not testify in her committee, and I'm just curious why that was.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, this was a gut and stuff in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I was not aware that it was occurring.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Al.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Tow Truck Association. We, too, offer our sympathies to the Lyons family. Madam Chair, when this bill first came out, Senate Bill 108, it was in our packet. I called the manufacturers of tow trucks here in the state and distributors, those that build and those that sell. The gentleman to my right is Mike Wagner, who owns Sanium Enterprises and builds and sells tow trucks as well as a tower. If you'll look at the material on page 10 of the handout the attorney gave you on the discussion with Senator Walker, when we first started our research, we used the internet pictures of those as the cross-view mirrors that we were looking at in relation to our industry and the impact it would have on our industry. We did not have on page 8 any idea, and I don't think we still have not come across mirrors that the attorney had before you, and I think they're on page 8 of this material. The cross-view mirrors that on the first page that I showed you simply would be very hard for us to put on some of the trucks, and we could not absolutely get them on quite a few models, the cross-view mirrors that you saw on that picture of the school bus. And Mike can most certainly more explain that to you why than I would even care to imagine that I could. Those are not easy retrofits on trucks. Of the type of trucks that we drive are not easy to maintain. We're forever in shrubs, bushes, backing out of driveways, and so we had a problem trying to put those, seeing how that would work. Some of the models they would fit, a long list Mike has of models that they would not fit. The ones that you saw today that the gentleman had, we've never seen those before. It looks to us like they attach to the top of the cab. We don't know if they'll work or not. We just don't have a clue. That's the first time we've seen them. And Mike would have to go back to the drawing board and look at manufacturer specs for windshield height and cab height to see how they would, in effect, fit. And that's all I have to say at this time, and I'll be glad to turn it over to Mr. Wagner.
Thank you. Want to go ahead?
I'm Mike Wagner. I own Sanium Enterprises and a company called Sanium Towing up in Lyons, Oregon. We have a towing company and we manufacture tow trucks. I'm a past president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association and a current board member. I think that part of the reason we're here is I believe that I'm not sure that the creator of the bill really intended tow trucks to be included in this, but we believe, based upon the language we've seen, that the tow trucks are included in this. I think we fall under the other property section. And are certainly the majority of the vehicles in our business are 26,000 down to typically 10 or 11,000. So I'm afraid we fit I'm not sure we were meant to fit into the category, but I'm afraid that we do. You know, the figures I did when I was just, I tried to come up with some cost figures, and several, the crossover mirrors that Al mentioned, the ones that mount on the drive pad in front of the trucks, several of the suppliers that I buy parts from regularly carry those, and the pricing I got when I looked at those in the catalogs and added our normal markup along with labor to install them, we're looking at about $250 a truck, maybe $200, somewhere in that range to put them on. And that's probably not in the name of safety, that's certainly not a lot of money. The big issue is that they're really not designed. None of the trucks that I've been able to identify so far that we use on a regular basis have the option of putting cross-view mirrors on from the manufacturer. So the peoples, the Chevys and the Fords and the Isuzus of the world don't offer us that as an option when we buy the chassis. So we're taking a generic product and trying to retrofit it to the truck. I'm anticipating that it's going to be interesting, at the very least, as we try and do that. I think it's going to be difficult sometimes to make those work effectively. Then you combine that with the type of work that we do on a regular basis, and I think it's going to be difficult to keep them on. So those are some of my concerns. I'm sympathetic to the cause. I'm not sure that the bill really has quite identified the niche they're trying to target. I think they have in mind what they want to target, but I don't think that's what the bill says.
Okay.
And that would be...
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Bob, you mentioned that UPS is the largest trucking fleet in the nation. I assume you folks represent UPS?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, they're the largest in the world, and yes, I do represent them.
Can you share with us, is the event that's before us, the tragedy that's before us, is that an isolated event, or is there a pattern that we need to know about?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you know, I tried to get some statistics that would be relevant to this population of vehicles that we're talking about. And unfortunately, we don't keep the statistics in a way that I can identify vehicles under 26,000 pounds. I can tell you that when you look at the trucking safety statistics, we have continued to improve decade after decade. My recollection is the total fatalities in Oregon for the trucking industry were about 14 last year.
I want to interrupt really quick. Thank you, Chair Beyer. We heard testimony from Senator Walker that her intention, and it's actually on a fact sheet that she handed out, is to focus on neighborhood package delivery trucks. What I'm trying to figure out, Bob, is there a pattern of these type of incidences within the largest trucking fleet company in the world? Or are we in Oregon, I guess? Or are we looking at a tragedy that has occurred here?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, knowing UPS, if there were a pattern, they would address it. I believe that this was an isolated incident, and because of the way that UPS trains their drivers, I believe that the cause was error on the part of the driver. That's my belief. They haven't said that. I do not believe that there's a pattern. And I think, you know, one thing that I didn't mention in my initial testimony is the vehicles that are not covered under this particular bill would be government vehicles. Anything with an E-plate is exempt, including transit buses and commercial buses. And since this bill has been scheduled, I've been sort of looking to see what's happening. This afternoon when I was coming back from lunch, one of the Salem Chariots buses came by, and it does not have Crossview mirrors on it. I saw one the other day in Canby, and it did not, and it was a smaller bus, and it did not have Crossview mirrors on it. The hut that takes people from Albany and here up to the airport doesn't have Crossview mirrors, and it's got a very long nose on it. So you've got some vehicles that are in the same situation as a school bus, in my view, but unlike school buses, they are not required to have, nor in some instances do they have, Crossview mirrors. And again, I believe that from the property or freight point of view, with the driver getting out of the vehicle to make the delivery, the safest thing is to make sure that there are no obstructions before they get back in that truck.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, as we attempt to legislate away human error, my concern is, and continues to be, that I have a district that borders on parts of Nevada and Idaho, and used to represent parts of borders with California as well. My concern is about these large interstate fleets that including U-Hauls, that and there's been no evidence presented today that indicates to me that the nationwide fleet of U-Hauls would be exempt when they move a vehicle into Oregon. Whether that's by design by the people who would like to move things into Oregon or out of Oregon. But I need to know what this may do to small vehicle fleets, and I say small vehicle in the terms of those that are 26,000 pounds or less, along my border communities that are making deliveries into Oregon on a regular basis. Maybe Al Elkins.
Madam Chair, for the record, Al Elkins, representing the Car Rental Industry of Oregon. We've done some research on under 26,000. We do rent vehicles, vans, cargo vans, small trucks for hauling, and it would affect them. We do. I again use the school bus front loaded mirrors for them to look at. We did not look at the other mirrors, but they did give me a physical similar to what Mr. Wagner said earlier. I did call U-Haul. I have not heard back from. I know what the rates are, but I don't know much more. I'm waiting for a call back to see
the amount is about $200 per vehicle that would be coming into Oregon. Was that?
The figures we were looking at, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, are between $250 and $300, but that includes buying the part and having it mounted, and that's the part that you saw, the mirror that you saw on the front of the school bus that I recall.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, to address the other part of your question, and I concur with Al that rental vehicles that were rented to companies that used them in commercial operations when they were transporting property would clearly be covered, and that would be a problem. As you know, those vehicles are all over the country and they just happen to end up in Oregon, and the owner's going to have to decide if they're going to rent it to a commercial operation, then they're going to have the cross-view mirrors. But the cross-border operations would be equally as affected. So that Vancouver, Washington, the trucking companies up there that provide deliveries into Oregon would have to have cross-view mirrors, yes.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, so I can assume then that if in fact the delivery of property or objects it would include things that we're delivering to our home on a move from Florida to Oregon, then that when that vehicle gets to the border, then it's going to be illegal at the Snake River border if it doesn't have these mirrors installed, even though it started out in Florida?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I think it depends on the nature of it. Yes, the rental is commercial, but if you rent it to an individual and they're transporting their own goods, I'm not sure that it would be covered. Okay. However, if you rented it to a moving company, and they do that all the time, and then it would absolutely be covered. So it depends on the application.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Russell, you mentioned some statistics early on in your testimony, and I'm just wondering if you could reference those. I think it was 14 incidents with vehicles with the cross.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, these were school bus and pedestrian-involved accidents, mm-hmm. and they're from 1197 to 123106. There were 14 accidents, and they were involving a school bus hitting a pedestrian. One was fatal, and the others ranged in severity from minor to severe. And there were also four accidents where a pedestrian hit a school bus, and I'm just not real sure how that works. But
would these, if I can follow, these are in the state of Oregon?
These are in the state of Oregon. These are ODOT statistics.
Okay, very good. And can you just tell me the source of where you got the stats from?
I got them from the Motor Carrier Division that keeps all the safety stats on commercial vehicles.
Great. And if I could follow just briefly, Jim, listening to your testimony and the concern of the definition, I do understand the concern about making sure we're getting to the vehicles that the proponents of the bill want to get to. The proponents are focused on vehicles that make multiple deliveries in a short period of time, the stop-and-go deliveries. If there is a way to define vehicles that do perform those functions, would you have more comfort with this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, by narrowing the scope, are we really improving the safety? And that's my concern. You know, when we talk about what the bill doesn't cover, and it doesn't cover transit or commercial buses, is that a good thing? I don't know. But if it's good for school buses, I don't know why it isn't good for transit and commercial buses. And in that operation, the driver doesn't get out of the vehicle. I continue to believe that in the property operation, that it's safer for the driver to physically clear the path before they get in the vehicle and move on. Could I see a scenario here where there was an option where you either had cross-view mirrors or it was your practice to clear the front? Sure, I could see that. Because then you could make a decision about which is the safest given your operation.
And one last follow-up, I mean, Madam Chair. Is there a source for UPS vehicle incidents? Is that information available?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, UPS itself?
UPS.
You just want that
right.
company.
Right.
I don't know.
Or, you know, the field, the industry.
Yeah. We don't distinguish it that way. And, you know, part of the misnomer here is, I think, is that people consider UPS to be a package carrier. Well, we don't use that definition because they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They haul shipments as large as Yellow Freight. They are a motor carrier, and they're hauling things from small packages all the way up to very large things. So I can give you statistics on the industry. The problem I have is that when we're getting down to these weights, they don't necessarily show up in the motor carrier statistics because certainly the vehicles under 10,000 pounds are not subject to the motor carrier safety regulations. And there's a fair number of those. So getting the discrete data to sort of answer your questions, that's tough.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one last question.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is a question for Judith. Senator Walker had made mention that agriculture was exempt. Were there amendments that I missed, or is there an interpretation I'm missing?
Said it twice, and I was looking for it as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, Representative Butler, I believe, and I am definitely obviously going to have a talk with Heidi and Legislative Council just to so that all of you are very, very clear on what's covered and what's not. I believe that if you look at the bill on lines 11 and 12, I believe that in her mind, a motor truck that's 26,000 pounds or less that is used for the commercial delivery of packages or other property, in her mind, that doesn't include agricultural applications. But again, I will consult with Legislative Council just to make sure if tow trucks or farm vehicles or rental vehicles,
thank you,
any of these would or wouldn't be covered. So you're clear about that.
Thank you.
That's what I was looking for.
Right. Thanks a lot. Thank you, gentlemen. Committee, we had a long schedule. I'd like to get through a couple more things, but we have a few more people, so we're going to try to keep them moving. Don Coates and Tammy Denny. So
sure.
Bear with me.
You bear with us, and we bear with you.
Welcome.
Hi. For the record, my name is Don Coates, and I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. This is Tammy Denny. She's our executive director. The previous comment in regard to exemption of the agricultural trucks is our purpose in being here is to clarify that issue. We did provide everyone with a summary from the DOT in regard
to truck safety. Excuse me, to truck safety. And if you would turn to page 8. Excuse me, page 9. The statistics show that in the year of 2005, the total truck crashes in the state were 1,300. And, hey, thank you. And that those crashes involved approximately 580 injuries and 66 deaths. But then on the following page, it shows the farm-plated trucks. And out of those total crashes, the farm-related ones were basically off the spectrum statistically. There's no deaths, 5 injuries and 8 total crashes of the 1,300. So, I just hope that that we, as an industry, could be exempted. I think the our sparsely populated area, we just don't operate in driveways, and I don't think the bill's intent was to probably to involve us, and I hope that whatever it takes to make us exempt will happen. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Seth, need to add anything?
Nope.
We're good. Okay.
I just had one question. Being familiar, slightly familiar with the configuration of the front-end cab of these trucks, in some places I can see that on farm trucks, if it wasn't impossible to install to get the full front view visibility, it would certainly be an obstruction to the view as you're driving down the road. Have you considered how the whole trucking industry could do this for these smaller trucks without creating obstructions in front? Again, I'm thinking of the lower snub-nose cabs that reach out there 10 or 12 feet, and I'm trying to get a mirror up high enough so I can see it, and so that will give me the view of the front, but without obstructing my other view. Mm-hmm. Can you help me with that?
I guess my perception of it would be that no matter how you placed them, it would have some interference in your visibility
forward.
But, there's trade-offs involved with those sorts of things. So I guess I'm not... I haven't given it a lot of thought because I just felt that our industry as a whole probably needed to be exempted, and I was hoping that that was the actual intent of the bill, but I wasn't clear on whether it was.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Scott Bricker, Olivia Clark, and Scott Ashcrum, if y'all want to come up.
Committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bricker, and I am with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. To be as brief as possible in a matter of time, I think Senator Przanski, I'm interested in speaking to the dash amendments related to the bicycle issue, and Senator Przanski did a great job giving an outline of what this would do, and I think a lot of the questions here are really valid, and I would be happy to answer some of the questions that, if I could. The background that I wanted to give is just to recognize that bicyclists are required to follow traffic rules and are recognized in the vehicle code as vehicles. So with that said, bicyclists, the law around bicycling is fairly new-ish and developing, and the law also identifies multiple places where there are operational differences between bicycles and motor vehicles and how to handle those. And from my perspective, we're still in the process of hashing those out, and every session we're taking on a couple of different ways to do that, and we have robust conversations, and we've done some good work in the past couple of sessions. This bill gets to one of those major issues. Right now, a car can't physically nor legally pass another car in the same travel lane. nor is a motorcyclist allowed to pass a car in the same travel lane, but a car can pass a bicyclist in the same travel lane. And as of last session, the same is true for bicyclists if it's safe to do so. So it's a pretty typical thing if you're driving down the road to pass a bicyclist, because a bicyclist might be going to 12 miles an hour and you might be going to 30. And that's a very reasonable thing to do. There are a number of other issues, and you talked a bunch about taking the lane. And the specific law around taking the lane, actually bicyclists are allowed to take the lane, and we actually do encourage bicyclists, more experienced bicyclists, to take the lane, but they can't be blocking traffic, and that's also in the law. So if there are a bunch of cars and you're taking the lane, a bicyclist actually has to pull over, just like a slow-moving vehicle going up a hill would have to do on a rural road as well. So there are some similarities there. The major issue here is that the current law has provisions for requirement for safe passing of the bicycle, but what is safe passing of the bicycle is the issue on the table. From the bicyclist that we standpoint, we hear every day more and more that traffic safety, riding bicycles in traffic, is the top concern. And that this is a major concern. As Senator Prasansky mentioned, it was a very high-profile death. One of his dear friends was killed. And so we're trying to create a scenario which is fair and balanced, but that states what a safe passing distance would be. The threshold right now is, and this proposal is, 30 miles an hour. So if you are going 32 miles an hour, if you're going a little bit, and bicyclists, again, is typically riding at 12 miles an hour, sometimes slower, sometimes faster, that you would be exempt from this minimum passing distance if you were going 30 or below. So if you were going 32 miles an hour up a hill, effectively you could slow down to 30 miles an hour to pass a bicyclist. And if you're going up a hill, a bicyclist is probably going more like 6 miles an hour. But the issue of speed and volume are really issues that we're facing here. Two pedestrians could walk next to each other, brush each other's shoulders, and there would be effectively, unless the one pedestrian is much bigger than the other pedestrian, effectively no injury. But if you have a motor vehicle going at 45 miles an hour passing a bicyclist at just a couple of feet, there is possibility, and this happens, for the bicyclist to get sucked into the vehicle. And for if there is a collision at those speeds, that the consequences are dire. The on page 2, number the section that basically says, the other kind of the bailout section here, is that we're clarifying that a car would be able to go over a yellow line if safe to do so. And so it's important to recognize that on many rural instances, when there aren't 5,000 person events, and that is an interesting issue, Representative Butler, that you bring up, but that a motorist would clarify that a motorist can go over a yellow line. Those yellow lines are really constructed thinking about cars passing cars or trucks passing trucks, a dotted line versus just a solid line. So we don't see any fundamental problems with this. Obviously we're here to hope that you all support this, but also to try and answer questions and work with the committee as this moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Olivia.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet. And just very briefly, I just saw these amendments today, and I'm a bit of a loss. I'm trying to work on possibly some alternative language that would really get at the case-by-case situation, both for rural, urban, and suburban situations. And I'll share that with Senator Prasansky. I want to say, too, that I really appreciate the work that he's done on behalf of cyclists. I'm a cyclist, too. In fact, I was one of those people riding to the coast that Representative Butler was talking about this weekend. Uh-huh. I was too slow to be in a pack of 50. I was out there by myself, not riding quite that as fast as the average rider, but I was doing it. But we do have some concerns. We're trying to have a peaceful coexistence in the metropolitan area. And the more bicycle lanes we have, the more biking boulevards we have, that's great. But if you look at the whole metropolitan area, there are probably, of the 90 bus routes that TriMet has, 15 of them are probably on roads where there are no bike paths. Their speeds up to 35 miles an hour, and it's not always a safe situation. Our operators are trained. Ideally, the standard operating procedure is that they leave a 4-foot gap, but that's not always possible. So I'm just here to say that I would like the opportunity to talk to Senator Prasansky about some possible alternatives maybe even an exemption or a four buses, not toll exemption, but maybe up to 35 miles an hour to deal with some of those 15 different bus routes that reach some of those conditions. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Olivia, as you're having that conversation, I'd just like to put a bug in your ear. In rural eastern Oregon, we have state highways where the speed limit is 55 miles an hour on two-lane highways on corners, hills. And so I'm sympathetic to the cause. I understand the issue. I'm trying to also think of the practicality, though, of implementing this in rural areas where I'm not sure it makes sense. And so I would just, we got State Highway 97 that runs from Biggs and Rufus all the way to the California border, and at times the speed limit's upwards of 65 miles an hour. And so I'm trying to figure out the practicality of this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. We're a general farm organization, nonprofit corporation, and we have members statewide, state of Oregon. Of course, you could probably guess that our major concern is with the farm plates and the way that this committee deals with farm plates. You've heard testimony from Mr. Russell that there are approximately 7,102 F-plate trucks in the state of Oregon. I think you'll hear testimony from the Farm Bureau in a moment that attests to a somewhat higher number. Nevertheless, there are a significant number of F-plate trucks in the state of Oregon. They're essential to agriculture, certainly essential to our members. The trucks are almost always operated off-road. They may have to use a highway, as this bill calls it, for short periods of time to take, for example, the onions or the sugar beets or the wheat or the potatoes to the elevator. But they're only on a highway for a short period of time, and then they return back to the fields where they really are an off-road vehicle in use. We have heard a lot of anecdotal testimony, both from members of the committee and from witnesses today, that it's not the intent of the sponsors of the legislation that F-trucks be regulated by the bill. Senator Walker, I just will quote her, she said, we are not talking about farm vehicles, end quote. Mr. Russell, however, has implied that F-plate trucks, in fact, would come under the purview of the bill, and we agree with him on that. In any event, if the intent of the committee is not to regulate F-plate trucks or farm trucks that meet this requirement, we would like to see the exemption overtly included in the language of the bill itself. Because, you know, when you get to court with anything, they go to the words that are on the face of the statute. And very seldom do they get so far as going into the legislative record and determining legislative intent by listening to these fine speeches that we're all delivering today. So we'd like to see an exemption for farm plate trucks inserted into the bill, and a nifty little place to do it would be on line 14 of the printed bill, the A engrossed. The sub 3 would read 3, this section does not apply to, and then insert the phrase F-plate farm trucks, comma, or, and continue with the language. Something like that, I think, would give clarity to the bill and would be very useful. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Here's my alter ego over here. I just can't go away from what Representative Smith just indicated. And as kind and wonderful as the folks are maybe over here, when you come around one of those hillsides going 55, and run into a pack of bicycles, it adds new meaning to digital communication. I have been flagged down by more bicyclists in Eastern Oregon than I have ever been given the finger by any people driving cars or pickups or trucks or anything else. These folks drive to a different law when they're in Eastern Oregon. They don't like to be near the sides of the road where those puncture vines are at, because they know what it does to make, you know, it adds new meaning to flat tires, because they just really don't like that. And I don't blame them, but my problem is that we don't expect them to be there, particularly out in the middle of Cow Valley, when you're coming around the corners on those hills there. It just is a real problem. So we've got to figure out how to address this issue with regard both the existing bill and the dash amendments that have been prepared for us relative to bicycles. We're going to have to figure out how to get along in Eastern Oregon and in rural parts of the state with packs of bicycles.
Thank you. One more, Don Schellenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Want to address Senate Bill 108 as it came to you, and appreciate Senator Walker's concern for agriculture. However, I don't see the exemption for farm trucks as clear as she does. Maybe I need some forward-looking mirrors. I don't know. Maybe that would help. But Mr. Russell did talk about what is other property. And when you look at this definition here, commercial delivery of packages or other property is what we deliver. And so that would seem to very clearly include us. As to truck size, I own a farm truck, farm-plated farm truck, and it's what we call a two-ton truck because it has a hoist on it, so you can dump the product. And its lightweight is around 9,000 pounds. And I haul wheat with that. I put on about 5 ton of wheat. That's another 10,000 pounds. That makes the total weight somewhere in the neighborhood of 19,000 pounds. This is a farm truck. It's single axle, dual rear wheels. Probably Representative Gilman probably had one or two just like it. Mine happens to be a 54 Ford. And I'm sure probably Representative Smith has driven such a truck as well. But that's the normal kind of truck in the farming area. Now, at least it used to be. Now, they're getting bigger now as far as that goes. But nonetheless, it would seem very clear to me that farm trucks would be included in this. I would suggest maybe a little different amendment than what Mr. Ashcombe, trying to elevate him here, was suggesting, amend line 12 simply by deleting "or other property." If her intent clearly was to deal with those that are delivering packages, if you just delete those three words, "or other property," it would seem to me that would clear things up in a real big hurry. And so I would close with that, and if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. That's all I have signed up. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and hopefully we can get some questions answered. I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to do hopefully a quick work session on Senate Bill 101 and then a public hearing and possible work session on 789, and hopefully it will go fast. So I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 101-8.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate Bill 101A, you'll recall this is the measure that phases in new permit and training requirements for Class 1 and Class 3 all-terrain vehicle operators, beginning with those under the age of 16, and phases those requirements in. You have before you two amendments. One we talked about on Monday, the -A6 amendments. First of all, I'll clarify that this amendment would apply to the offense of operating without driving privileges if you're 16 years or older, or operating, we're talking about ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, or endangering an operator, if you're responsible for a person on the all-terrain vehicle that is between the ages of 7 and 16 years of age, and it would exempt from those new permit and training requirements all-terrain vehicles used exclusively in farming, agricultural, or forestry operations, or used by persons licensed under Chapter 571 exclusively for nursery or Christmas tree growing operations, and vehicles being used on land owned or leased by the owner of the vehicle. So we have those exemptions from those new operating requirements. Now, we do have, that just came out of Legislative Council today, you should have, and please let me know if you don't, the dash A8 amendments. These are a modification of the sevens we talked about on Monday. The dash A8 amendments apply to the offense of failure to wear a helmet when you're on the ATV. So in this case, we're just adding, if you look at the amendments, we're adding for those persons under the age of 18 years, we're adding that they have to wear a motorcycle helmet with a fastened chin strap. They already have to wear a motorcycle helmet when operating the ATV, but now we're adding with a fastened chin strap. The current statute exemption applies. You'll see that on the amendment, first page, lines 12 through 15. Again, those same exemptions we just talked about, and that is the vehicle is being used exclusively for farming, agriculture, or forestry operations, nursery or Christmas tree growing operations, or, in fact, on the private land owned or leased by the vehicle owner. So you'll see that repeated a couple of times, and that is also requiring the fastened chin strap. Again, if you're carrying another person that's under the age of 18, they have to be wearing a fastened chin strap on their helmet. And again, the same exemptions apply for the operations we just spoke about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And committee, a reminder that this bill is being moved to Ways and Means today. So I am willing to accept any motions we have here.
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
On page 2
of
the bill itself.
Bill itself.
And perhaps I missed this, and I'm sure that's quite possible. Can someone share with me what the rationale was for requiring Class 3 all-terrain vehicle operator permits? I'm sorry. I misunderstood the question. I apologize. I withdraw my question.
Oh, okay.
I apologize.
Well, I didn't answer.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A6 amendment to Senate Bill 101.
Madam Chair, are we working on dash 8 or dash 6? Are they exclusive? Or
they're two separate amendments.
Thank you.
And one is one that has been agreed upon. The dash 6 was agreed upon by the sponsor. So we want to make sure that. Representative Tomei has moved the dash 6 amendments dated 5-7 of 07. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? So adopted.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A8 amendment to Senate Bill 101.
Representative Tomei has moved the dash 8 amendment dated 5-23 of 07. To Senate Bill 101. Any discussion?
Dated 5-23. Oh, did you say that? Okay, sorry.
I thought so, but I might not have. It's getting late. Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Is that it?
Yep.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 101 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means of the DuPass recommendation. Is that right?
Close. Representative Tomei has moved Senate Bill 101 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Buffy? Aye.
Representative
Dillon? Aye. Representative Smith? No. Representative Perez? Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and hopefully we have people that have come for the Senate Bill 728. Or 789. Yes. So we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 789.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 789 authorizes a Share the Road license plate as a nonprofit group plate under the existing group plate program. It adds a $10 surcharge for the 2-year registration period and directs that revenues generated and deposited into accounts designated by the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and Cycle of Oregon. It directs the department to work with the two bicycle groups on the design of the plates. We do have before you coming around now, just out of Legislative Council, the -A2 amendments to this particular measure. The -A2 amendments delete language specific to Share the Road registration plates and instead allows for a group plate for the purpose of promoting the sharing of the road with bicycles. You'll see that the account and the specific language related to either the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and Cycle Oregon or specifically to Share the Road plates is replaced with more generic language that would apply to any plate that promotes sharing the road with bicycles. I guess one other thing I'll point out on the -A2 amendments is that it simply specifies that the plate shall contain an image of a bicycle in that instance. We do have, let me double check, you do have a revenue impact statement from the original measure showing a less than $25,000 impact per biennium on revenue. We have a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. No subsequent referral at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. And Senator Prozanski, would you like to come up? Yes, you may.
Chair of the table.
I assume this is everybody who's, almost everybody who's signed up. Committee, and before we get started, I just wanted to say that the A2 amendments were amendments that I had drafted up because you're all very aware of my love of license plates and, and special plates. And so this was not drafted by the sponsor of the bill, and it really is just sitting there for my benefit, probably more than anybody else's. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Floyd Prozanski, State Senator, District 4. I'm here today with a number of individuals. We're asking this committee to move forward the Senate Bill 789 as the A engrossed. In this case, now that I understand there's a -A2 without that amendment. We have handed out to you just now samples of the plates that are used in other states, and there are different configurations that are used by those different states, basically giving the same message, though, and that is called Share the Road. You're going to hear from various individuals today as to why we believe this is important. I will just lay the framework before we get into the testimony of the individuals, then I'll ask the chair to allow me to kind of do cleanup as to finishing up. Is that there are two issues that we're attempting to address here. Number one is education and awareness for individuals that the roadways of this state should in fact be shared equally by all, and that the law actually requires that people be not only courteous, as we've heard from one of the members previously, but to respect each other as to what the rules of the road are today. The other is a promotional aspect of what the plates we believe will actually foster not only in the state but outside of the state as well, and that is an economic growth. You will be hearing from today first Thomas Jefferson. Tom is the husband of Jane Higdon, who I mentioned to you in the bill that when we talked about 108, and the purpose as to how he, myself, and others that have committed ourselves to try to bring a message to all Oregonians and regarding the rules of the road and also the philosophy of sharing the road. You'll hear from Jerry Norquist from Cycle Oregon, as well as from Scott Bricker from BTA, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, regarding their perspective of how this type of license would in fact accomplish their goals that they have as mission statements within their organizations. And with that, I'd ask TJ to go ahead and go first.
My name is Tom Jefferson. I'm a physician involved in safety for patients in hospitals. I would like to thank the committee and Senator Przanski for the opportunity to speak to you and offer my support of Senate Bill 789. My wife and best friend, Jane Higdon, is 47 years old, was killed last May on a Wednesday afternoon ride with three friends on a section of Territorial Road just outside of Eugene. Territorial Road is an essential gateway to a number of beautiful rides southwest of Eugene to Lorain, Wolf Creek, Cottage Grove, Creswell, and parts south. It provides access to many of Lane County's fine wineries. She was struck by a fully loaded log truck in a no-passing zone on a straight but narrow section of Territorial where the fog line actually goes off the road to drop off onto gravel, and where a log truck basically takes up the entire lane with no room for bicycles. Jane was an experienced cyclist who rode thousands of miles a year, had ridden that section of road hundreds of times, and was riding with experienced cyclists. Jane had graduate degrees in nursing. She was a family nurse practitioner. She had a master's in exercise physiology, a doctorate in nutrition. She authored two nutritional textbooks, numerous scientific articles, authored the Micronutrient Information Center website at the Linus Pauling Institute in Corvallis, and was internationally recognized as a top source for reliable scientific information on vitamins and micronutrients. She was an avid endurance athlete, participating in numerous local swimming, running, and multi-sport races, and had participated internationally in her specialty Ironman triathlon. She had participated in 7 international and 2 world championship Ironman competitions. We all remember her for her love of life, her warmth, sense of humor, personal determination, willingness to share her knowledge with others, and great accomplishments in her life. For her short time here, she brightened up many lives and left the world a better place. She died, though, still wondering if she had done enough or made enough difference in her life. Jane's death has left a gigantic void for those of us who knew her well. It's also left us unwilling just to be depressed or angry for a while and then move on. A group of us that have been working on a number of fronts to continue Jane's spirit in a significant and lasting way, and we're dedicated to have some positive impact come from this tragedy. That is why we support the bill and strongly encourage its approval. Jane and I had the opportunity to take some cycling vacations in France and Italy. riding some of the most famous rides in beautiful areas in those countries. While those trips were fantastic experiences, when we came back to Oregon, we always remarked that the cycling right out our front door and within easy access to us was right up there with the best cycling in the world. And we never tired of the great cycling opportunities we have in our great state. Oregon should be known, as other great areas of the world are, as a place that's safe for cyclists and motorists who peacefully coexist and respect each other. That's good for us as individuals, it's good for our culture, it's good for the economy of the state. This vision cannot be accomplished without safe roads and without attitude change. I believe there are no barriers to accomplishing this goal that can't be overcome with perseverance, steady coalition building, and refinement of vision, as we've heard today. What better goal could there be than to provide safe roads for various types of vehicles, particularly human-powered ones, in a world of diminishing resources? Many areas in the world have figured this out and are taking advantage of it. We're in a situation now where there's more and more cars on the road all the time, and there's more and more bicycles on the road all the time. We have to address this situation. We can't sit still and just stick our heads in the sand about it. To provide safe roads for all requires a cultural mind shift for many, which will not take place without action. Many motorists believe they own the road, and the roads are built for them, and that bicycles have no right to be on the road and are an aggravating impediment. In frustration, they take chances that often endanger vulnerable cyclists, all too often running them off the road, or in this case, resulting in fatality. There are many more motorists and cyclists who understand that they should respect each other and each other's safety on roads that are that both are lawfully allowed to access. This bill allows the majority to demonstrate their support for the simple concept of sharing the road. And with other simple actions like this, we can shift attitudes and awareness to an increasing majority. Jane's friends and myself pledge ourselves to this effort, and we hope you will too. Jane's death is a reminder to us all that you never know the time of your death, so the time to act is now. Why wait? Thanks for the opportunity to express my support for this bill.
Thank you. What's next?
Okay. Madam Chairman and Representatives, I'm Jerry Norquist, the Executive Director for Cycle Oregon, and I want to thank Floyd and you for the opportunity to testify for this bill. I just would really like us to address this from a policy issue. And when you look at Oregon as a cycling state, we have been the leader in this country for many years. 35 years ago, this body passed the only bicycle bill that exists in this country today. No other state has a bicycle bill. We do. We are a leader in recreation. We're a leader in transportation. Oregon has more bicycle-friendly cities than any other state in the country. And by bicycle-friendly cities, those are the cities that are designated by the League of American Cyclists as qualifying for certain standards. It's platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. And there's a lot of work that goes into getting those designations. Portland is a gold city, and it's one of the only major metropolitan areas that has that designation. Along with bike-friendly, when I say recreation, the recreation component here is very large, and Oregon also has the designation as the best mountain bike area in the country. That's quite an honor based on the fact that we're competing against states like Colorado and Montana and other places. We are also mentioned often in publications. We were just in an article in the Wall Street Journal 3 weeks ago. Oregon was looked upon as one of the leaders in cycling for transportation. 2 weeks ago, Andy Clark, the president of the League of American Cyclists, testified in front of Congress. The bicyclists have finally been invited to the table to talk about transportation issues. And Andy Clark, in his testimony, mentioned Oregon on two occasions as being one of the leading states in the union representing cyclists. Bicycles are part of the solution and this is why I think share the roads is a policy issue. Cycling addresses a number of issues that we're confronted with today. The health issue that we're confronted with, the obesity that we see in our children today, cycling is a solution to that. Cycling is also a solution to the congestion, the pollution, and global warming. And instead of trying to cut back on cycling, we really need to expand on it. And share the roads as a policy can help accomplish that. Our mission at Cycle Oregon there are a number of things that we go after, but the big one is education. We try to educate cyclists on proper behavior when they're out on the highways. I've heard some interesting comments. We, as you know, Cycle Oregon, go into rural Oregon, and the other mission we have is economic development in rural Oregon. So our rides focus on small communities. In fact, Jonathan Nicholas has often said the smaller community, the larger the welcome. And we find that. And I would say for every irritated motorist we get on the road when we're out there with 2,000 people, we will change the minds of probably 50 people in a community who see that these are people just like them. They just ride a bike instead of drive a car. But I also want to state that probably 95% of the people that come on our ride are also active motorists. They transport themselves every day by their car. So we want an opportunity to show that we do want to share the roads, and one of the ways to do that is to have that emblem on our automobile that says that we do support this. I want to mention that sharing the road is a cultural issue. Tom had mentioned that he had been to Europe to cycle, and I have also been there a number of times. I just got back from Italy, and it's a cultural issue. In Italy, I never had to worry about a car running me off the road. When I say cultural, it's ingrained in their driving mentality that when they come up behind you, they will either wait until it's clear to pass you, or they will pass you, giving you a fair amount of room. But I never once felt threatened there. Unlike riding my bike, I live in Eastern Oregon, and I do ride to the right of the road many times. Motorists are irritated that you're even out there. So we would like that opportunity to express that we want to share the road. So with that, I also want to mention the Outdoor Industry of America just did a study on cycling. And I want you to be aware of what the outdoor industry is saying the economic impact is in the state of Oregon. There were 21 states that they did a breakout. Cycling was one of the breakouts, along with fishing, hiking, camping. The economic impact, according to the Outdoor Industry of America, on Oregon, the Oregon economy, is $465 million. Cycling directly employs 2,306 people, and we indirectly employ 6,663 people in the state of Oregon. 28.2% of our population uses bicycles. That's a considerable amount. So the economic impact is considerable, and I think as cyclists we'd all like to show that we support it by having the opportunity to have a license plate to represent that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you again. My name is Scott Bricker, and I'm with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I'm also with the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, and from our standpoint, both of the organizations that I work with focus almost exclusively on traffic safety, and we try to increase the number of people bicycling and walking, and there are a lot of reasons why, and you've heard those today. There are lots of people bicycling. There are more people driving, and our roads are getting more congested, but I first want to assure you that we are working with programs. We have our Safe Routes to School programs, we run traffic safety programs, we run TV programs, we have promotional programs. This is an effort that we're working on. The Share the Road campaign would be an ongoing program. This would be an effort for people to wear effectively on their cars their support for sharing the road. And I want to state, while I represent bicyclists and walkers, and we're clearly, it's an incredible classy act. I mean, we're really talking about people who are upstanding members of our community. We also recognize that some of the bicyclists don't always follow all the rules. Some of the car drivers don't always follow all the rules. The intention behind this effort is targeted at sharing. It's targeted at all the whole audience. This is not pointing fingers. This is trying to state to everyone on the roadway that when you're out there, that the intention is to give each other a break. And Representative Smith, I think, talks about that. You know, I mean, you've talked a lot about that. You know, just if we were just a little bit more curious, if we're willing to give up a couple of seconds to ensure the safety of the person next to you, it's an essential thing. Finally, because I think a lot of the issues have been covered that are really important about how cycling is important, I want to talk about the nexus here. I was around last session when there was another license plate bill, the Smokey the Bear bill and whatnot. The reason why this bill makes so much sense is because we're talking about the roadway. This bill has a clear nexus. The concept between sharing the road and the license plate is just, that's why so many states have gone this direction. It's because you're out there on the road, and this is a reminder for you at every moment to be courteous to the person next to you. So this, to my standpoint, is really a safety program, in addition to perhaps a program that might help fund safety programs that would be administered by two really upstanding organizations and working with other folks. But the nexus of this effort is to increase safety and the recognition and the perception of safety on the roadway. So we think that this would be an excellent opportunity for Oregon to build that support in that program. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can go ahead and just wrap up, and then we'll take questions. With all due respect to the Chair, I understand the A2s, and she and I have spoke about her position on license plates. I am going to ask the committee to move the bill forward as is. We want the flexibility to either do a standard plate like the group plates have or use one that could be a little bit more customized. The handout that I've given you shows you what 7 different states have done. I can assure you, number one, that our plate, if we went to a more specialized type plate, would not be like Texas. We would not use y'all as much as TJ and I might want to, since we're both displaced Texans by choice. But the reality, when you look at it, the one plate that would be closer to maybe what the tree plate is for us is the North Carolina plate. And I would ask you just to look at how the message there is given forward as compared to the others that actually has what I call branding a message. And that branding the message is share the road. And I know Bob Russell's here for the Oregon Truckers Association. I will share with you that ODOT started a program with the Truckers Association about share the road. That program has actually expanded beyond just the truckers into a more universal use. And Bob and I have had some very good conversations about how we all want to make certain that we have safety. And we believe that this type of plate will, in fact, increase safety because it just will give more of awareness to those individuals out on the road when they see the plate. And it's kind of like a mini advertisement, as you've heard from Mr. Bricker, as to making certain that we are actually remembering what we can do for each other and how we can make the road safer. Regarding the money for the plates, there will be no out-of-pocket expense, quote-unquote, to the state. That is an obligation that we will be taking on. I can tell you in my discussions with various individuals and organizations, including Cycle Oregon, that's here at the table today, BTA, Oregon Truckers Association, and other individuals that are willing to put forward the money that's necessary to put the plates forward. And so with that, we are asking to have the bill passed as it came to you out of the Senate, allow for some flexibility. We will work with the department. We will work with state police to determine what is a plate that would be appropriate to make certain that we are, in fact, going to be not only in compliance with state law as to what the plates need to have and how they can be displayed, but also making sure that they're legible and readable for public safety. All of you know my background, my day job as a prosecutor. The last thing we're looking to do is have some plate that you can't read and understand not only the message that's there, but also the identification for what the license plate in the state actually serves for. But I think you can see from the examples from other states that can be accomplished and actually allow for that message. So with that, Madam Chair and committee members, We'll take whatever questions you may have.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. Jerry, I just want you to know the event you put on is fabulous. It is first-rate. Cycle Oregon this last year was in District 57 throughout my district. And I'll tell you what, those folks just do a first-class job. And your message of being able to show the goodwill is so true. Just got to keep bringing it out there to Eastern Oregon, and I think you'll continue to get more converts.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And I think you really summed it up well when you said we wouldn't even need these things if we could just be a little more courteous toward one another.
Any other? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm, of course, supportive as a sponsor. I wonder if you could talk about how you decided on Cycle Oregon and the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, two worthy recipients, and if there might be flexibility going forward for other recipients that might begin. I'm thinking of the Community Cycling Center as an example in Portland, if there are other opportunities for complementary organizations and so on.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Reed.
That's fine.
What I was going to say is this. I should have gone over this. I apologize for not going through this. The way we have this set up, those two organizations that are there are the ones that will actually receive whatever money is coming in. Realize this. There was a decision that was made by this group that we're not trying to raise funds here. We're not attempting to actually fund these two organizations as compared to getting the message out. The dollar amount that's on these plates is $10, one-time additional fee as compared to what you'd pay for a regular place, a license plates. And that in itself will, in fact, offset some cost, but it's not to offset the full cost of what it would cost for the plates. We felt that it was more important to get the message out there instead of looking for this as a revenue-generating process. What we know from speaking, or what I know from speaking with the Department of Transportation, that when you do have these extra fees above and beyond, that they actually will see a diminishing in the support of the plates as time passes on. And we felt that it would be better to have an ongoing message as compared to looking for raising funds.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. I have a real quick question, and that's you were talking about that your plate would probably look more like North Carolina's plate as opposed to any of the rest of these. I'm assuming that North Carolina's plate is kind of one of their standard license plates in North Carolina as opposed to a specialty, or because it looks like it, you know, with the airplane and everything on it. So.
Madam Chair, I apologize. Maybe I misstated myself when I was explaining what this is. I was showing the different examples of what the right. plates look like. And what I thought I was saying on the North Carolina plate, I believe that is their standard plate, knowing their plates, and that they would use, that would be more of a, what we would consider more of the group plate concept. I was not supporting or saying that our plate would necessarily look that way. The discussion I've had with some of the funders is they wanted to have the flexibility that was possible under the state law as it's currently written to allow for making sure that we got the, I guess what I'm going to call the best plate that gives the branding and the message. And what I was showing is the differences as to when you look at these various plates, it would be easier to read "Share the Road" on a plate that is not the North Carolina plate, but clearly this shows what would be more of a similarity of a group plate here. Now, what we do understand in, from ODOT and DMV is that the plate itself would not be a specialty plate. It would not be listed on the renewal forms as a specialty plate, and it would be something that these organizations would have to be promoting to maintain the sale of those plates. The reason these two organizations were chosen is because of their presence statewide and their following as to the impact they've had throughout the state. And again, that was calculatedly done for education purposes, knowing that they had the ability to deliver the number of people who would be willing to purchase the plates, use the plates, and we believe that there are many cyclists that come in contact with both Cycle Oregon and BTA that will learn of the plates and their availability.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Jack, if you want to come up for last words. And thank you, committee. I think we're almost done.
You betcha.
Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. Let me be very brief, and if I may take issue with a statement that was made by Scott Bricker. It's not Smokey the Bear. It's Smokey Bear.
Have we learned nothing this session?
How many sessions?
So, we have had a number of discussions with Senator Prozanski on this plate, and we stand ready to work with him and his groups to design the plate. The plate will be a group plate. It won't be a specialty plate, one of the three specialty plates. This bill gives us the flexibility of designing this on a tree plate with a decal and perhaps using more of a smaller configuration of letters so there's more geography on the left side of the plate for a decal, or, as was mentioned, a completely unique background plate. In any event, it will still be a group plate, and the proceeds will be shared among the two groups that were mentioned. The price is the standard $26,000 for a group plate. $10,000 of that is the application fee, which is given back to the folks if they sell 1,000 of these in the first 12 months. They're then expected to sell or renew 500 each year to have it be maintained as an active plate. So it is a group plate. It may end up looking a little bit different, but we stand ready to work with these groups to put this together, and I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any questions. I think we're all done.
I just want to clarify that, so you would use the regular tree plate, is that what you're saying, and then put over that a decal or something that would show a bicycle would share the road?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, there are two options in this bill. Unlike, for example, another group bill with a logo on it, like the University of Oregon, that's a tree plate, and all of the group plates are on tree plates. And on the left side of the plate, there's space left for a decal, and that can be the logos of the universities, or it could be Smokey Bear. What this bill does would allow us to have some type of a picture of vehicles, a car and a bicycle, or a bicycle or whatever is decided on that side of the plate, still being a tree plate. You could have a smaller configuration of letters, like maybe three letters, which would leave open the entire left side of the plate, left of the tree, to have a larger area to make a presentation on. That's the one option. The other option that's allowed in this bill is to have a completely unique background. And that would be different colors. That could be something like the display that was given to you by Scott showing the various different states. So that would be a new kind of group play. There would be a new kind of fancy, different background. It wouldn't be on a group plate. So the bill gives us the option to go
follow
either way.
Follow.
So that would be the same cost to ODOT or DMV, the new plate?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the cost, of course, will be borne by the proponents. But the actual cost to design a plate, whether it's the Medal of Honor plate or the Veterans plate, the upfront cost to put that together is insignificant. The costs that are associated with these plates are principally the programming them into the system. So if you think that there's, you know, I originally thought there must be huge expenses involved in designing and the artwork and putting it on, and there really isn't. In the grand scheme of things, it's pretty insignificant.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 789 and open a work session on Senate Bill 789. And committee, if there's a motion.
Madam
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I know, I'm just going to notice that you have a couple members that are missing. I have spoken with at least one of them. I'm not sure if you were going to try to move the bill today or...
Like right now.
I am. I'm moving the bill.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 789 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves Senate Bill 789 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion, Senate Bill 789 should go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll say aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Excuse.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Excused. Representative Tomei? Aye. Chair Wyatt? No. The bill carries, and would Representative Reed like to carry this?
Thank you.
Close the work session? Or
no, go ahead.
On Senate Bill 789?
Madam Chair, did we need a carrier for 101?
It went to Ways and Means.
Right. Okay.
So,
all right.
So no, we don't. I'm announcing now that I'm going to carry over the rest of the bills. Senate Bill 108, we'll hear again on for a public hearing and possible work session on next Wednesday, the 29th.
It's 30th, sorry.
And Senate Bill 728, we'll carry over for a public hearing. For a work session, and SJR 15. We'll go ahead and have a public hearing and possible work session on that one. And then I am, any other announcements? Well, we're closed. Thank you.
Madam Chair.